morning to get procedurally correct on a couple of bills. Senator Walker, if you would make a motion for rule suspension.
Sure, Mr. Chair. Man, how many amendments do we have on this bill?
A lot.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended on which bill?
All three, actually.
All three? On Senate Bill 620, House Bill 2696, and House Bill 2770 for the purpose of reconsidering the votes.
All right, Senator Walker moves that we reconsider the vote by which the committee sent out Senate Bill 620, House Bill 2696, and House Bill 2770. Any discussion on the motion? And I'll just say that there apparently were ways and means referrals. We did not rescind them or request rescinding, and we have to go through that process. So.
Mr. Chairman, move that we rescind the referral to Ways and Means on SB 620.
You're just a bit premature. Motion passes.
Yes.
Now, Senator Walker, if you would, on 620.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 620 was sent to the floor with a D-pass recommendation.
Senator Walker moves that we reconsider the vote by which this committee sent out Senate Bill 620. Objection to the motion? Objection. Motion passes. And then there will be a motion to the floor with this.
With the rescind.
Got
it. Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 620 be sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and that we rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
All right. Senator Walker moves Senate Bill 620 be sent to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation and that the referral to the Ways and Means Committee will be rescinded. Predicated upon the Senate President's approval. Discussion. Any objection? Wanting to be voted against it?
Well, it said as amended, and I wasn't sure we had amendments.
The dash one.
We did.
One
we had
amendment.
A dash one. Okay.
All
that's
right.
Fine.
You're constantly checking up on the staff, and that's good.
That's good.
All right. Any objection or further discussion? No objection to the motion? Motion passes. 2696, please.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2696 be sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and that we rescind subsequent referrals to Ways and Means.
All right, Senator Walker moves that we reconsider the vote by which we sent out House Bill 2696. Senator Walker, any objections to the motion that I substituted for?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I have to start all over from the top.
That's okay.
Any
objection to reconsidering the vote? There is none. The motion passes. Now you can do that.
Okay. And there was an amendment. It was dash three. Now I move that House Bill 2696, as amended, be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that we rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
All right. Senator Walker moves that House Bill 2696, as amended, be sent to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded, predicated upon the Senate President's approval. Any discussion or any objections to the motion? Motion passes. 2770.
We have one more. Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2770A was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
All right, Senator Walker moves that we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2770 was sent to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? Motion passes.
A lot of words. It's early in the morning, but Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2770A be sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and that we rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Senator Walker moves House Bill 2770 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation and requests that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded. Any discussion? Any objection to the motion? If not, the motion passes. The previous carriers that were signed will continue to carry. We're back on House Bills 2094 and 2368. And public hearing on those two bills jointly. And, Council, we were going to move to, I think.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think last time when we met last week, we had the gentleman from Single Stick was finishing up because he had to go back to Arizona. And as I recall, we were going to move to the representatives of the tobacco, the product manufacturers, who are part of the master settlement agreement. So I know Mr. Nelson's here. I don't know who else wanted to testify. Gardner's here.
Mr. Gardner, Mr. Nelson, do you want to come up together? Or are there others that need to come up? I don't have a sign-up sheet in front of me.
Yeah.
I'll just get my paperwork together here for you all together. So.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm an attorney with the Gardner & Gardner Law Firm, and I'm here today representing Philip Morris. You have before you a checklist of the requested amendments to House Bill 2094 and House Bill 2368, which we are submitting. Two amendments to House Bill 2094. One, which is a significant substantive issue, is the allocable share amendment. The second, the A-10s, is a technical cleanup amendment, which in essence, the major purpose of that is to provide that upon seizure of contraband cigarettes, they will be destroyed in all cases. 2368, two technical amendments, one which covers the situation where internet sales are paid by check. The second, which deletes a cross-reference to federal law, which is unnecessary since federal law applies by its own force to the situation of labeling. Let me begin by saying as simply and as starkly as possible, we have a situation in the state of Oregon that is out of control. We have contraband and unlawful cigarette sales which are basically devouring the tax revenue and the MSA revenue that this state is so dependent upon. Mr. McCauley testified that a reasonable estimate is that between 30 and 40% of all cigarettes consumed in the state of Oregon are one way or another unlawful, black market, gray market, contraband, untaxed, counterfeit, 30 or 40%. That's an enormous number. And that's a number that is growing even as we speak. I must say that until very recently, the official bodies within the state of Oregon, the official departments responsible for collection of this tax, were in a state that I can only describe as a state of denial. When you saw estimates that perhaps $10 million was being left on the table, contrasted with what Mr. McCauley now says of 30 to 40% of all sales being unlawful, that's a state of denial, and it has to come to an end. The philosophy of our amendments, generally, is that the state of Oregon needs every possible enforcement tool, including active involvement by the private sector, meaning the major companies, the OPMs, original the part of the manufacturers, they're signed on to the MSA. You need the active involvement of the private sector as an enforcement partner to combat this this problem. This is the same model that we employ in the antitrust law, where the private right of action serves an essential policy function to help enforce those laws, the same principle that applies in the unlawful trade practice context and in other contexts as well, in a bill that will hopefully soon pass through the legislature in the context of spam enforcement. It's a product, it's an approach that is applied again and again. And just as we would not think of withdrawing the private right of action from the antitrust law, there would be an enormous storm of protest if we were to do that, and properly so. So, too, we should not plausibly consider withdrawing the private right of action that is in House Bill 2368. That part of the bill, it's already in the bill. Now, the allocable share amendment needs to go into 2094. All of the fees that are collected under the private right of action, all of the fines, do not go to the private plaintiffs. They go to the state of Oregon. The reason private plaintiffs would be, private companies would be incented to file these suits is because they have a competitive reason to have a level playing field. But the money recovery flows to the state of Oregon. Now, I want to suggest to you that you heard some testimony that from the representative for Single Stick that the NPMs are unable to litigate aggressively. And I suggest to you that there is some contrary evidence to that, that is inconsistent with that statement. I've passed out the pleadings, which are available on the official NAG, National Association of Attorney General, website, the pleadings in a case styled State of West Virginia versus Carolina Tobacco Company. The allegations in that case, and I'm looking at paragraph 17, include an allegation that defendant Carolina Tobacco Company improperly and intentionally withheld $500,000 plus from escrow from April 15, 2002 to the present. And to my point of aggressive litigation approach, you also have in your packet an order from the Circuit Court of Kanawha, I suppose that's the way you pronounce it, County, West Virginia, in that case. And what is remarkable and interesting about that order is it is an order to dismiss for lack of in personam jurisdiction. In other words, the aggressive litigation posture taken here in response to an allegation of intentional withholding of escrow payments was not, gee, can't we get together and work this out? We'll submit to the court's jurisdiction. It was rather, you don't have in personam jurisdiction over us. Let me turn then to the allocable share amendment. That was recently adopted in Idaho and more recently unanimously in the state of Washington. It corrects a significant loophole. It is supported by NAG, the National Association of Attorney Generals, and you have in your materials the NAG statement in support of it. Pete Shepard said that basically, he doesn't view it as essential now, but we're probably going to need it next session. Our position is we have a revenue crisis right now. We need every tool that we can lay our hands on to deal with that revenue crisis. Now, one of the reasons that that bill passed unanimously in the state of Washington was because in the state of Washington, SIPMA argued, as it is arguing here, in part, that another state, and this happened to be the state of Kentucky, and I'm going to read the SIPMA testimony very briefly. The Kentucky General Assembly rejected the measure in part based upon a fiscal impact statement showing that passage of the measure could cost the state almost $1 million in revenue in the first year. That assertion was met with a response from David Horn, who is the Assistant Attorney General in the state of Washington responsible for tobacco matters. And I'm going to read basically the response of the Washington Department of Justice to that. Speaking of SITMA's testimony up there. They also submitted a copy of a memo from the Troutman Sanders Law Firm of Richmond, Virginia, stating that the identical bill was killed in Kentucky based on a fiscal note, quote, showing that passage of the measure could cost the state almost $1 million in revenue in the first year, unquote. The information provided to the committee was not accurate. That's not my statement. That's a statement from the Washington Department of Justice with regard to the allocable share amendment. And having received that, the Washington legislature went on to pass the allocable share amendment unanimously. This issue is not about being nice to big tobacco or being nice to little tobacco. This issue is about protecting the state of Oregon's entitlement to tax revenue and MSA payment. And I suggest, in contrast to the suggestion by Mr. Shepard, we can't afford to wait. We can't afford to wait till next session. We have a revenue crisis right now, and we urge that this committee adopt the A5 and A10 amendments to House Bill 2094, the B15 and B16 amendments to House Bill 2368. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brady.
Could you elaborate a little bit on the A10 amendments? Because I think most of your comments apply to the A5 amendments.
The A10s, and let me just see if I can lay my hands on them quickly here. The A10s have two principal purposes. The first is to explicitly provide that product that is forfeited under the Oregon forfeiture, the generic Oregon forfeiture law, shall be destroyed in all cases. And the reason that's necessary is because there are options for resale of forfeited product, and that's simply not appropriate in the case of tobacco product, which could either be an expert counterfeit product or stale or otherwise inappropriate for resale. So you don't want that stuff coming back into the retail stream. And the second major portion of these amendments are to ensure and this is you'll pick this up on lines 4 and 5, to ensure that there's full coverage of roll your own, because roll your own is not roll your own cigarettes are obviously not stamped on the pack. The underlying tax is paid as an OTP, other tobacco product tax, and so you want to be sure that you're getting at that situation as well. The others are purely cross reference corrections and that sort of thing.
Thank you.
All right, other questions?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mark Nelson, Public Affairs Counsel, representing R.J. Reynolds Tobacco. I want to expand on what Jim has said and provide you some information regarding what has been the impact of Oregon since the Master Settlement Agreement, based in terms on both the Master Settlement Agreement and also on the level of taxation, and then walk you through an example about the loophole that we have found in the Master Settlement Agreement and the NPM, Non-Participating Manufacturer Statute. I think to preface the whole debate, I think it's very important to point out that since the Master Settlement Agreement, by our numbers, is prior to the Master Settlement Agreement, what we term non-participating manufacturers, those manufacturers outside of the participating manufacturers, the amount of their sales prior to the Master Settlement Agreement was about 2%. That number has grown to 13%. Since the Master Settlement Agreement, and we believe it's not by accident. And in addition to that, it's not the typical tobacco companies that we once saw before the Master Settlement Agreement. We have dozens and dozens of new tobacco companies that have started since the Master Settlement Agreement, and we would maintain it's primarily because of the loopholes that we are now seeing in the marketplace. The first piece of information I want to draw your attention to is on Public Affairs Council stationery, and it's called Oregon Master Settlement Payments Projected versus Actual. You will see since the Master Settlement Agreement, we had projected payments to the state of about $384 million over a 5-year period. The actual payments to the state is $320 million over that 5-year period, a $64 million drop in the actual payments. We would maintain that one of the principal reasons for that drop is the ability for NPMs to come in and not participate in the required escrow requirements that all 46 participating states have passed, requiring NPMs to place their dollars into an escrow agreement until the end of the 25 years. If you go to the next piece, and this is the Oregon what we call the Oregon Cigarette Tax Review. Richard Kosasan has put these numbers together, and they've been reviewed by the Legislative Revenue Office. But you begin to see again a different side of the picture. We've had tax increases since 1996 through 2003 of 236%. The actual amount that we have received in the tax increases for that period of time is only 89.26%. So you begin to see that we've had a remarkable increase in the tax, but a just as remarkable non-collection of the tax. Now, some would say, well, that's because consumption has gone down. And some of those on the anti-tobacco side have heralded that as a reason that in fact, consumption has gone down. In fact, what they have done is gone to the Department of Revenue and said, how many tax stamps have you issued during this period of time? And, in fact, the number of tax stamps being issued has gone down. But consumption has not. At the bottom of that particular page, you will see the consumption from 1996 to 2000. And you can see it ranges from a low of 20.7 to a high of 23.5. And it is fluctuating up and down within about that 2% range. These aren't our numbers. These are Centers for Disease Control numbers, which actually track consumption, not tax stamps, but the consumption within the state of Oregon. So not only have we had a massive decrease in the amount of dollars that have come through the Master Settlement Agreement, but a massive decrease in the amount of tax dollars that we've collected. Now, this is not just because of the MPMs. I should point that out. We have black market. We have gray market. We have cross-border sales. Idaho is at 28 cents. We're at $1.28. We have Internet sales, and we have Indian sales. To back that up in terms of the tax side, you'll see a letter or a memorandum to Representative Witt during the last legislative session. And I take you to the last paragraph, which says, using 1997-99 biennium as the best compliance period, we have projected a decrease in revenue of $100 million in 01-03 biennium. Some of this decrease is due to fewer people smoking, but we estimate that most is due to noncompliance. So even back in April of 2001, we had a very clear picture of the direction we're going, and it has gotten worse. Now I want to take you to the loophole that we see in the NPM statutes. And again, these were, when they passed the Master Settlement Agreement, the Attorney Generals agreed with the major tobacco companies who participated in the agreement that there would be legislation passed in all states setting up non-participating manufacturer statutes, setting up an escrow so that non-participating manufacturers would pay into escrow an amount that would even out the market, that so they could not undercut the majors, which in turn would undercut payments of the Master Settlement Agreement. This is called Loophole in NPM Exhibit T legislation. It works like this. The original agreement thought that all of these tobacco companies, as they were then in most cases, were selling in 46 states. So the formula was set up to sell that as if they were selling in 46 states. What has happened is the non-participating manufacturers sell only in maybe four states or six states or three states. And this is what happens. This is the example that we show you here. They sell 1 million packs of cigarettes in three states, California, Washington, Idaho, and Oregon. You can see the amount that they're required initially to deposit, which in this case is 27 cents per pack. That's $270,000 that they had to put in. You're required to put that amount into escrow. But this was based upon thinking that they were going to be paying into 46 states. But they're only paying into four. But they still pay that $270,000. Then they turn around and they say, come back to California. And they said, but your share of the national market of those 46 states is only 12%. We paid you $205,000. But you should have only gotten $34,463 because that's your share in the national market. We say, well, but you only sold in four states. That doesn't make any difference. You can only collect or you can only keep $34,000. Therefore, you must give us a refund out of that escrow agreement. They have to pay it in, but they're eligible to come back and ask for the refund. So out of $270,000, they get $170,000 back because they're only selling in four states. They take that $100,000, put it back in to buttress their other sales. In other words, to lower their price of their cigarettes. They subsidize that with that money. So they come in and undercut the participating manufacturers. And they're doing this all over the country. In the other piece that you see there, there is an email and from out of North Carolina. And you'll see in 2002, a manufacturer by the name of S&M, they paid into escrow $8,425,000. They came back and said, we need a refund because we didn't, they don't say we didn't sell in 46 states. This is all you're allowed to take, $692,000. They were refunded $7,732,000 that they would not have been refunded if, in fact, they were selling in all 46 states. So the Alcohol Share Amendment fixes this problem and closes that loophole, which is a significant loophole. The end result is additional losses to the state of Oregon, as well as other states in which this takes place, and it's taking place throughout this country, in their master settlement agreements. Again, I want to bring you all the way back to our first statement at the beginning, is that at the beginning of the process of the master settlement agreement, these manufacturers had 2% of the market. There is a reason why dozens have come into this market to take advantage of these kinds of loopholes, and there's a reason why they have a 13% market share now. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you. Questions? There are no questions. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Get John Valley from the American Heart Association here.
Good morning.
Go ahead, sir. Just introduce yourself for the record and tell us what you want to tell us.
Okay. Chairman Minnis, members of the committee, first I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is John Valley, and I'm the Oregon Advocacy Director for the American Heart Association. I'd just first like to say, as I go through my testimony, I wrote this thinking that Courtney Dresser, who is representing TACA, would have already testified. And
but you wanted to testify.
Well, that's okay. And
why don't we have
on the list.
That's fine.
And as she's coming up, I'd just like to comment real quick, because it's not included in my written testimony, based on something that Mr. Nelson had just said. I got the impression that he is claiming that part of the reason we've seen a lack of consumption in the state of Oregon is due to the fact of smuggling and illegal sales, where, as my understanding, the American Heart Association is a member of the Governor's Tobacco Reduction Advisory Committee, that there has been a direct link with the tobacco prevention and education program that's been started since 1997, and that program, a comprehensive tobacco control program, has shown great results in reducing consumption. And I know Dr. Cohn, the state epidemiologist, is in the audience, and he could probably speak to that. If I encourage the committee to invite him to talk to that, because I think he has some different information than Mr. Nelson had provided in his earlier testimony. Throwing that out there. Because
I don't think I'm going to make this thing a forum for the efficacy of the prevention programs.
Okay, I just believe there is some concern that if the impression is left that the reason why we're seeing a reduction in smoking rates is solely due to the fact
that's
of
not
smoking.
What he said.
Okay, well, that was the impression I got, so I apologize. I was running around and trying to follow
what
he was saying. Okay, I'll go to my colleague if she'd like to testify first.
Good morning. My name is Courtney Dresser. I'm with the American Cancer Society, and I'm here on behalf of the Tobacco Free Coalition of Oregon, TACO, regarding House Bill 2368, and very particularly about the bill relating to the funding of the Compliance Task Force and the creation of the suspense account for these purposes. TACO is very supportive of enforcement activities and the collection of otherwise foregone taxes we are concerned about the construction of the suspense account and the open-ended statutory language that is currently proposed in this bill. The creation of the suspense account is envisioned will cause a fund shift. The Task Force for Enforcement currently funded from General Fund would, under House Bill 2368, be funded from tobacco tax revenue. The fund shift would cause a reduction to the programs currently funded by these taxes. The cost of that shift is about $2.3 million for the Oregon Health Plan, $90,000 for tobacco prevention and education programs, and $158,000 for local government for senior and disabled transportation costs, and $646,000 for the general fund. While it is our understanding there has been some sort of compromise struck to hold the Oregon Health Plan harmless, the offer has not been extended to any of the other programs. We are hopeful that increased enforcement activities will result in a greater amount of taxes collected and a decrease in smuggling and other illegal activities. However, as this bill is written, if the task force is unable to collect the amount of money projected, then the cost of the task force would be borne by the tobacco revenue recipients without the offset of overall increased tobacco tax revenues. If such a reduction takes place, it would decrease the funds to all the programs. A special concern to us is the impact to the tobacco prevention and education program. TPEP is a program that has already been slated for reduction in 0305 by shifting 50% of the voter-mandated funds from the tobacco use reduction account to the general fund. Our biggest concern with House Bill 2368 is the open-ended language used to fund the task force. There are several sections of the bill, Section 5, Subsection 3, Section 27A, and others, that use the wording amounts necessary to pay the expenses incurred without any limitation as to the amount. While it is a budgetarily capped in 0305 by the appropriations process, it is impossible to know what might be allocated in future biennia or in this biennium by the emergency board. These uncertainties could result in higher cuts to the programs like tobacco prevention and education. We're assuming that the reason this was done because of the budget crisis, which we understand, and we believe that the original mechanism of funding the task force through the general fund was the most appropriate method, rather than shifting the cost of the task force to all the other programs that currently receive tobacco tax revenue. We would therefore like to revisit this funding option at another time, and we have drafted some amendments and have gotten the support of the Attorney General to sunset this funding option in 08, I believe. It's a four-year sunset. And it's -B22.
Could you hold on just a moment? I'm not sure I heard you correctly. You have the support of the Attorney General on that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So you have not.
We have the support of the Attorney General. Pete Shepherd is here to say that too.
Okay. Just need to get the support of the legislature.
So it's -B22. And basically what it does is just sunsets that account and allows us to kind of look back at this at 08. We also, TOFCO is obviously very willing to work on tightening the language in regards to the amounts necessary, but we do encourage this committee to pass the 2368-B22 amendments and sunset the suspense account so we can take a look at this. Not only to look at the funding, but make sure the task force is doing what we hope it will do.
All right. Thank you, Courtney. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, have your organizations taken a position on the allocable share amendments that are being discussed, the 2094 and the amendments that are being discussed by the tobacco industry on 2368?
Senator Burke, Chairman Menace. We haven't taken a firm position on that. We're still trying to understand them. The main focus for us with this bill and 2094, and we haven't really focused on 2094. Our testimony is really focused on 2368. It seems that there is a dispute between the quote-unquote big tobacco and small tobacco companies regarding that issue, and we're trying to stay out of that one. No one's actually approached us, and we're kind of not taking a position one way or the other. The only thing that we were concerned about was the issue of what's causing the reduction in consumption. That would be the only thing we would comment on.
Thanks. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ferriero.
I guess I have to admit I'm a little surprised by the approach. I would think that the good work of the American Cancer Society and the American Heart Association would be facilitated, and there would be more resources available if we actually collected all the taxes that were due. And I understand the concern about the open-ended appropriations language for the task force. But the task force was created in the last legislative session based on testimony that the tax avoidance could be certainly is over $10 million, could be as much as $50 million, and might be, according to the demographic information, as much as $100 million. And it's more than circumstantial evidence that indicates that every form of tax avoidance will be employed, legal and illegal, when there's a tax increase. And that was a predicted curve. The predictions are absolutely accurate. The avoidance seems, if anything, to be greater than was anticipated. So I would wonder why the Cancer Society and the Heart Association wouldn't come out very strongly for absolute enforcement, interdiction, apprehension, prosecution, and recovery of all sums due and owing to the state of Oregon, since those are the things that fund the programs that you rely on. So I guess I'm really kind of surprised by the approach that, we're worried that you might spend too much money on going and collecting the taxes that are owed. Seems a little incongruous with the position that I know that you're in.
Senator, there's a couple things. None of us, TOFCO or the members, including Cancer and Heart, want to say we're not against enforcement, because that would be completely wrong. We definitely want enforcement, but at the same point, we have to have prevention. You got to have all the tiers there. And like I said, tobacco prevention is already facing almost 60% of a decline in the 2003-2005 budget if that doesn't get changed, and then another hit here. Again, you're right, it's completely possible by the end of 2005 this task force will do what we all hope it will do and pay for itself and everybody else. But at the same time, we're going to be lost without having some prevention programs. The state needs to have that. But again, please let us, I just want you all to know that we're definitely for enforcement, and we want to pay that. We want to do that, but at the same point, there's other things you've got to do, too. And the Oregon Health Plan is looking at for a major cut, too, with this, if it doesn't work.
Mr. Chairman.
Hi, Senator Fairley.
The gangster and the smuggler and the illegal operator stealing money directly from your program. And I would think that you'd be more than happy to join with the folks, even at the risk of an open-ended appropriation, to go get this $50 to $100 million, and I believe that. But, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to belabor the issue.
Actually, I appreciate the fact that you are. All right.
Can I make a quick comment on that?
Don't you have some additional testimony you wanted to
make? I do, but I think it's key. I really want to emphasize, from the American Heart Association perspective, Chairman Minnis and Senator Ferriero, that the only reason we're really testifying on this bill is not because of all the good work it does in reducing the illegal sales, collection of taxes, the task force. That is not the intent of the Heart Association or, I believe, of TOFCO. The main concern is the funding mechanism of the task force, which was general funded before, and then there's been a new proposal for reducing illegal sales, which we're all in favor of. It's just a matter of which it's being funded. And that's why we're supporting the -22 amendments, because therefore we have going back to the general fund allocation, which we think is the appropriate allocation. That's what was originally envisioned in 2001 when the legislature approved the task force and created it so we can reduce illegal sales. Because we do want an increase in legal sales of tobacco products so we can collect the tax revenue that is supposed to be allocated to the various programs, which Senator Fairley has referred to. So I just want to make that very clear. And then I'd be happy to go on to my other testimony.
All right.
Thank you, Senator. Again, I'd like to associate myself with the comments that Ms. Dresser had made. I'd also like to talk about a couple of the amendments that were offered during the last hearing on this bill, specifically the Dash 16 and the Dash 18 amendments. The Dash 16 amendment, as I understand it, is being offered as a technical amendment, and I don't know if the issue that is raised is addressed somewhere else in the bill, but as I read the bill, this is what it does. Currently, the language in the bill requires a prominent and clearly legible statement that consists of one of the warnings set forth in the Federal Cigarette Labeling and Advertising Act for any advertisement or website that promotes the sale of cigarettes. I believe the amendment was offered by one of the quote-unquote big tobacco companies, and I'm not sure of the reason. On its surface, the amendment seems to indicate there is no need for health warnings on websites or advertisements to promote the sale of cigarettes. We would disagree with that proposition and encourage the committee to maintain the health warning provision of the bill. That's what it reads to me. There might be a reason for the amendment that I'm missing, but it seems to say that we don't need the warning signs for any sort of promotion or advertisement for sale of cigarettes, and we would disagree with that strongly.
Let me ask you this question, John. Have you talked to the
I haven't had a chance to yet. I'm just trying to it's pretty straightforward in the bill. It just deletes that provision. I can't find anywhere else in the bill that deals with a warning for promotion of cigarette sales on the internet or an advertisement. So as it reads, we would be opposed to it, and unless there's some reason for it that we're missing. In addition,
you don't know whose amendment it is?
I believe it's Mr. Gardner's amendment.
How do you know that?
He said so. I think he's the one who offered it, and he spoke to it in his earlier testimony just before we were up
here. You haven't talked to him about it, right?
I have not talked to him directly about it, no.
Go ahead. I encourage you to do that.
Okay. In addition, and this is the Dash 18 amendment, which was offered by CITMA, and I have talked to CITMA about this amendment. It seeks to create a Master Settlement Agreement Task Force. The language in particular in the amendment that is troubling to me is that it gives the task force the ability to make, and I'm quoting from the amendment, make recommendations on issues related to the Master Settlement Agreement, including but not limited to issues relating to Oregon's share of funds coming from the Master Settlement and issues related to business involved with the production and distribution of cigarettes and tobacco products. In the amendment, there are eight members designated to be on this task force to provide these legislative recommendations to the legislature next session, but there is no members of the public health community on this task force. As the amendment reads, this is not just limited to business transactions or economic issues. It goes the whole spectrum of the MSA, which has many public health policy issues in it. So I'm not sure if the need for the task force there is a need for the task force, but if the committee decides to move forward with the amendment and create a task force to make legislative recommendations to the legislature, I would encourage that members of the public health committee were appointed to it as well, whether it's at least one person from the Tobacco Free Coalition of Oregon, a member of the Department of Human Services who implements the Tobacco Prevention Education Program to at least sit on this task force, I think would be very important. That's a basic summary of my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions at this time, and I again thank you for the opportunity to testify.
All right, Mr. Ballard, thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Ballard? There are none.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Make sure you chat with
I will.
Mr. Gardner. All right. Marshall Coburn. And is Dave Redman coming up with you?
Yes, sir. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Marshall Koba. I'm here this morning representing Council of Independent Tobacco Manufacturers of America, CITMA. CITMA is a national trade association comprised of ESTRO-compliant small tobacco manufacturers. Our members are non-participating manufacturers to the Master Settlement Agreement, and I'm here today in support of the Dash 17 and 18 amendments to House Bill 2368, and we also support House Bill 2094, as currently before the committee without the amendments brought forth by the Dash 5 amendments. In regards to House Bill 2368, we are very supportive of the original intent of the bill. Internet sales to minors is a very serious issue, and we support the efforts of Oregon and states across the country to enforce this and other laws to eliminate this problem. We are suggesting two amendments to the bill. The first will improve upon the amendments adopted by the House Revenue Committee, and the second proposes an interim work group to further study the Master Settlement Agreement and any proposed changes to ensure that they do not harm Oregon's share of the MSA funds and Oregon companies that deal with the production and distribution of tobacco products. We believe that in an attempt to identify and capture all the available revenue due to the state, the House Revenue Committee has sent a bill over that has unintentionally gone too far. We support their goals, but offer the Dash 17s to make it fair, we believe, for our members. These amendments, the Dash 17s, will amend Section 82 of House Bill 2368. Currently, Section 82 allows our competitors, the major tobacco companies, to work with or independently of the Oregon Department of Justice to enforce tobacco law in Oregon. These include tax law, internet sales law, escrow laws, and others they deem appropriate. Oregon's tax laws provide that much of the information on which such suits would be based is confidential to the company that files it. This policy of allowing our major competitors to hassle and to ultimately litigate us out of existence is poor public policy, will cost the state tax revenues and jobs that would otherwise be generated by our SITMA members and their distributors, and should be rejected. If this continues, please understand there was no discussion in the House about how much money may be found, what is the appropriate process for these private rights of action, nor how the Department of Justice and the deputized tobacco companies would work in tandem to go after compliant or non-compliant tobacco companies. These changes, we believe, could lead to significant unintended consequences in regards to litigation regarding the Master Settlement Agreement, and the more than $70 million Oregon receives annually could be at risk. Our Dash 17 amendment will continue to allow the Department of Justice to have the authority to enforce tobacco regulation in Oregon. The Department has testified that they have adequate tools now, and with the addition of House Bill 2094 and with the addition of 2368, to perform their duties in regards to tobacco regulation and enforcement. These amendments make a fair and non-general fund revenue impact change to the bill. It continues to allow the Department of Justice to enforce tobacco law, including the escrow provisions, and that's proper and where it is today. However, it eliminates the ability of our major competitors to bring suits against us in regards to ORS 293-535. And I handed out to you this copy of the ORS statute 293-535, and I've highlighted the C over there. The C, sub C, which talks about the AG's enforcement provision and how that process works. However, it eliminates the ability of our major competitors to bring suits against us in regards to this ORS 293, which is the escrow provision of the Master Settlement Agreement. This escrow provision is a very important and sensitive area of the MSA law, and one that should not be amended without a full and careful understanding of the law surrounding its original drafting and adoption by states across the country. That purpose was to equalize the impact of the MSA on participating and non-participating manufacturers by requiring non-participating manufacturers to make a contribution to escrow roughly equal to the MSA payments of the participating companies. The escrow provision was never meant to guarantee the major companies a market share. Further, the escrow provisions have little impact on the state's general fund revenues since they are placed into an escrow account to satisfy any potential civil actions brought against manufacturers in Oregon. And I would say little impact on the state. I think that's an overstatement. Actually, there's no impact, potentially some, but small at the most. The Dash 18 amendments, stated earlier, simply put together an interim task force. The language is somewhat boilerplate. We're not wedded to that language at all. We just feel that the issue deserves a full vetting and a full discussion throughout the interim. There are a number of issues here that seem to be changing, not only locally, but throughout the state. Throughout states across the country as they adopt the amendments that have been brought forward by the major tobacco companies. We have found a great deal of misunderstanding among legislators on the issues surrounding the MSA, and believe an ongoing interim committee can and should flesh out these issues to enforce the more than $70 million owed each year by the original participating manufacturers is not put in jeopardy. Several lawsuits have raised and are raising interesting questions about the MSA, how it is administered, and who has standing. Recently, Oklahoma established a legislative task force to study these issues. We have seen major amendments to bills brought forward by major tobacco with significant impact on the MSA and escrow law in Oregon. A task force will be a great place to better understand these amendments, ongoing case law regarding the MSA, what's going on in other states, the goals and policies, which I think is very key to this whole issue, of the National Association of Attorney Generals, NAG, and other timely issues certainly to be brought forward in future sessions. We urge your adoption of these amendments to House Bill 2368. We believe that Oregon public policy, as reflected in its legislative pronouncement, should be based upon fair competition and not designed to tilt the playing field in favor of or against any segment of any industry. I believe that in regards to House Bill 2094, that Mr. Deere did a nice job the other day of talking about some of our concerns there. I would just like to point out to you something that I think any time in this business you can find maybe a third party that can make your case for you. I think that Major Tobacco has suggested that this is not an issue about fairness or big versus small, but it's about money and it's about protecting the MSA, and we couldn't agree with that more. And I think that this handout that I gave you, the Citigroup Smith Barney two-pager, Smith Barney, of course, is a major investment house in the United States, not necessarily political. I mean, I'm sure they're very political, but this is a update dated June 9, 2003, just last week, that talks about what's going on in tobacco and the investment world. Their interest, I think, is to get a return on investment for their investors, Philip Morris, for the four major publicly held companies. If you read that second page, it talks about the issues that we've seen here in Oregon. And I think it's fascinating when you look under the allocable share, which happens to be the -5 amendments to House Bill 2094. If you read through that paragraph, there's one sentence, I think, that sticks out and sums up this whole issue very nicely, and the one that we're going to hang our hat on, because this is what we've seen across the country. And then I've highlighted for you, basically, the purpose of the allocable share is to force the compliant NPMs to drastically increase their price. That's what it's about. I'm going to say that one more time. The purpose of this legislation is to force the compliant NPMs to drastically increase their prices. It has nothing to do with the MSA. And we've heard discussions about market share. There's a lot of reasons for market share moving up or down. We understand that in order to fund their MSA obligation, they need to pay about approximately 30 cents a pack, and I can get more detail on this if the committee were to request it. However, to fund their master settlement share, they have increased prices. They increased prices immediately about $1. So they increased prices, the majors did, by about three times what was necessary. And that, as we all know, in the elasticity of price, may have had some impact on their market share. Also handed out this morning, and to follow up on what Mr. Deere had said on Wednesday, there's a lot of unverified information in this whole issue. And again, that goes back to the interim work group. And if there's not an interim work group, I would hope that the committee makes it a priority, maybe have at least a couple of hearings on the issues around here, because last Wednesday we read into the record a California case which talked about the independent auditor, that all these numbers, that all this stuff's based upon, all these suggestions of decreased revenue and projections and numbers and money not showing up in the kitty are run through an independent auditor. And interestingly, in California, as was read in the record again, and I'll just very quickly, Mr. Chair, the independent auditor does not audit or otherwise attempt to verify information supplied by the SPM in response to requests for information as set forth above. Rather, the independent auditor accepts at face value the information supplied by the SPM, including the information on their market share. Independent auditor not auditing. So we go across the country, Mr. Chair and members, to Vermont. So we've got California on the west, Vermont on the east. I've got something dated December 20th, 2002. Another fleeting, and at the bottom in the footnotes, and Vermont is important, I think, because there has been Vermont was one of the leading states in settling the MSA. And again, highlighted on the bottom, and I'll read it into the record. Neither Management Science Associates nor the independent auditor, quote, audits, end quote, the shipment information provided by the OPMs. Instead, both merely take the information supplied at face value As a consequence, the fewer cigarettes that an OPM reports as having shipped during a particular year, the lower its relative market share will be, and hence, an OPM reports as having shipped during, and hence, the less money the independent auditor will determine the OPM owes under the MSA for that year. If fewer cigarettes that an OPM reports not only affects the OPM's base payment obligations, but the base payment obligations of the other participating manufacturers as well. Hence, B&W, Brown & Williamson, one of the majors, who was one of the original signatories to the MSA, reported volume of cigarette shipments is a key factor in independent auditor's assessment of the base payment obligations not only for Brown & Williamson, but the other participating manufacturers too. The bottom line is, when an OPM, like B&W, underreports the number of cigarettes shipped, Vermont and the other settling states receive lower settlement payments than they bargained for and expected to receive when they settled their claims against the OPMs and entered into the MSA.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Ringo.
I guess a couple things. One is the chart that was presented by Mr. Nelson has a citation number 5 to the CDC indicating the adult smoking trends in Oregon. It kind of goes up and down, down slightly. But Mr. Nelson makes the argument that according to CDC, we haven't seen in Oregon a huge drop in the incidence of smoking, and certainly not a drop that would explain the decrease in revenue. I guess my first question is, do you accept the CDC numbers as accurate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I'm not familiar with that handout. I think that it might be fair to assume that the significant increases in price that we've had, the tax increases that we've had in tobacco for cigarettes, has led us to, and exactly that chart is the reason that we have before us, House Bill 2368 and House Bill 2094. There is a problem. We believe that is a solution to collect the money. So not knowing the numbers, no, I don't know the numbers, and I can't accept those, but I think that's the answer is, these bills for additional enforcement collect the money that's owed.
Well,
we support that.
I guess the point that they're trying to make is that we have a significant leakage of revenues, and you can see that because the smoking, the amount of smoking hasn't dropped significantly, yet revenues are dropping. And if that's something you, I guess, you're not prepared to either agree or disagree with.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I think that Internet sales have been significant. I think cross-border. I think one of the earlier testifiers suggested that Idaho was 28 or 30 cents a pack. I mean, that is a huge difference between what you can buy in Ontario and you can drive to my old hometown, Caldwell, 25 miles away, and buy a lot of cigarettes
for
a lot less price.
That's right. Okay. Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
I mean, the problem that you were just referencing about the independent auditors not really performing audits, I mean, how do we solve that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I don't know how we solve it, but I think we understand it. And I think the key to this whole issue is that we acknowledge the fact that the independent auditor doesn't audit. And I think that might be news to some on the committee. It was news to me. It's probably news to some of the people in the audience that are listening, because I don't know what we do about it as a state, but the fact of it is there's a problem there, and I think that we need to take a look at all these numbers and question them and try to make them as legitimate as we can through whatever means that we can.
Essentially, though, you're saying it's really hard for us to have confidence in the numbers that are reported by the OPMs.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, no question about that.
And I've got to ask the question, what value is that to this discussion? Because by implication, saying the auditor doesn't audit indicates to me that you're assuming that they're under-reporting their cigarette sales, but I'm not sure exactly what that has to do with the legislation that we're discussing.
Mr. Chair, I think that it's I think the reason that it's relevant is because that we are making policy decisions based upon revenue needs, revenue concerns to the state. We are in a very tough time here, and I think the House Revenue Committee took a look at opportunities to create revenue through allowing, for instance, the major tobacco companies to be deputized to assist the AG in bringing private rights of action. So I think we're looking for money. I think that it's important that we base policy decisions on the most appropriate data that we can find.
Okay, but and maybe I'm mixing this up, but I'm looking back at the allocable share argument. I mean, it's pretty clear that we're, as a state, losing money based on that scheme.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, which scheme?
Well, the scheme, the assumption that you have 46 states, that each of these independent companies is selling in 46 states, and that you can thereby, you know, I guess allocate just the state's share and get a rebate on the monies that have been withheld. I mean, maybe you should speak to that issue. That, I mean, clearly, I guess, I have a keen sense for the obvious as a detective. It appears to me that the states are getting screwed.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce with me this morning Dave Redmond, President and CEO of Carolina Tobacco, who, similar to Mr. Deere last week, has the pleasure of participating and competing in this area on a daily basis.
All right. Mr. Redmond.
Chairman Minnis and members of the committee, I'll try to be brief and address your question first. There is, I believe, evidence being put together as we speak that, in fact, there was a position report put together at the time the best legal minds in the United States put together the Master Settlement Agreement. The concept of having a refund available for non-participating manufacturers, non-signers, as we understand it from people, attorney generals and assistant attorney generals who were present during this discussion. The reason was so that an NPM would not pay more per carton or per pack than a signer, than the misbehaving big tobacco. Because if that should happen.
But wasn't one of the underlying assumptions that that money would stay in the fund for a period of some 20 years and then would be based on whether or not there were any suits filed or successful litigation, that money would then be rebated as opposed to the current situation?
Well, yes and no. Each state was required to, in order to get the master settlement money, was required to pass the Model T statute. And Oregon has basically the same statute as all other 46 participating states. In that Model T statute, the statute that Oregon has as well, it states exactly what you said, in addition, that is, that the escrow fund would remain there for 25 years and then if unused would be refunded. In addition to that, Chairman Minnis, it also says that an NPM refund calculation will be done. And that's the way the legislation reads here in Oregon. Again, the purpose of it, as we understand, and we'll have, if we have a bit of time here, and that's why I'm suggesting to the committee to postpone adding the allocable share, to postpone that. That's our recommendation, is to find the position reports that the drafters of the MSA had in their hands when they put this NPM refund into the Model T statutes. Because this, and I don't mean to be threatening here or arm waving, but the fact is there are some good legal minds right now that are saying the five states that have passed the allocable cap legislation will be challenged in court, and there's a possibility that the MSA itself will be reviewed. Now, that, as we understand it, was the purpose of the NPM refund. And to repeat, so that a non-signer NPM would not pay more per carton or per unit than Big Tobacco, the original OPM signers. And that's what it's for. So if I answer your question, Chairman Minnis?
Well, this state gets sued on a regular basis. I'm not so terribly concerned about that. I guess the question was, for me, is whether or not the attorneys general, when they crafted the MSA, assumed that tobacco companies were going to get these huge rebates back, or whether there was an assumption that the money was going to stay in the fund. Again, because it assumes that there may be successful litigation against the non-participating manufacturers for distribution of cigarettes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, again, I don't have the history in front of me, and personally, I don't care if the state gets sued. I'm a little concerned about whether or not Idaho, Montana, and Washington have currently passed the allocable share amendment and what that means in terms of the distribution of cigarettes in the state of Oregon and what happens vicariously in terms of our economy. I think the state can adequately defend legislation in this area if we choose.
Well, pardon me, Senator Dennis, I would suggest that from some of the comments I've had from good legal minds in the U.S., that there is, in fact, a serious possibility that the allocable cap will be challenged successfully. CIFMA itself has done legal research, and we believe that's the case. So I believe there is a danger here that the MSA or parts of the MSA may be challenged because of it. So my strong recommendation is in step with Pete Shepard's, and that is to wait, to have a task force to review these very complicated matters. Frankly, our position is entirely the opposite of big tobacco. So what does one do in a situation where the same facts end up with diametrically opposed opinions? It's usually to do further study and to postpone, and that is my recommendation.
All right. Thank you for your recommendation. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Redmond, since you just mentioned task force, I wanted to ask both of you gentlemen. We had testimony from Mr. Valley here a few moments ago about that task force. He's very concerned there aren't any public members on that, any public health members. What do you think about that?
Chairman and Senator Walker, I think the task force language in the Dash 18s was actually put together from the Oklahoma draft. We're not wedded to that, and if there's suggestions to make it better, we're open to that.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? No other questions. Any final comments?
I have one comment, if I may. And that is, there's been quite a bit of discussion about the market share now being approximately 13%. I'd like to put in the record that Big Tobacco has raised the prices of their cigarettes three times. That's triple the amount required by the MSA. So I put it to you, why have they lost some market share? Could it be price?
All right. Thank you very much.
Well, yes, Mr. Chair, do you agree with their argument that you have 13% of the market now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, Mr. Deere, who was here last week, put on the record that CIFMA had done a study which showed that NPMs have about 9% market share.
Okay, that's what I thought he had said in my office, and I've not yet reviewed the tape of the hearing last Wednesday. I'll do that before we make a decision here. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
I appreciate your testimony. Anyone else wishing to testify on these two bills? All right. If not, we'll close the public hearings on House Bill 2268 and 2094. We're going to take a 5-minute recess. We'll be right back on 3329. House Bill 3329. Council, why don't you tell us where we left this off and which amendments were supposed to consider?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if you recall, House Bill 3329 is the Attorney General's bill. It does three different things. First thing is it allows the AG's office to participate in preparations for responses to mass disasters. The second thing it does, which is the one thing we did not hear testimony on last time we heard this bill, is it allows the Attorney General's office to act as the lead plaintiff in securities class actions lawsuits. Currently, the Attorney General, because it's a public organization, is not allowed to act as a lead plaintiff if there's going to be other private civil parties involved, which means that it can't control litigation in certain situations involving securities, most notably if the PERS system purchases some type of security that ends up being a poor investment due to some kind of fraud or other securities violation. The AG's office would not be able to take, as I understand it, the lead role in that litigation. So the Second Amendment would allow that to do that. The Third Amendment is the no-call issue that we heard most extensively last week. And as you heard testimony, there is now going to be a federal no-call program. And so that's the third issue is whether Oregon can designate the federal list as its own no-call list. Last time we heard this bill, there was some concern that the current no-call administrator was going to lose its contract in light of the federal designation. And we heard testimony from Hardy Myers, the Attorney General, that it was the intention of the AG's office to honor the contract until it ends, which is currently set for January 14, 2004. The chairman was to have an amendment drafted that would add that to this bill. That is the -A10 amendments that you see in front of you. The intention of the amendment is just to essentially reiterate the statement from the Attorney General that they intend to honor the contract until January 14, 2004. That's all it says. If there is a breach of the contract on either side, obviously both parties maintain their remedies. If there is sufficient cause for the AG to get out of the contract and that cause is set forth in the contract, we did not want to specifically over preempt any of the contractual terms. All we wanted to do was set forth that it was the intention of the Attorney General to follow that contract until June 14, 2004. I understand that the only other amendments under consideration are the -A8s.
All right. We have somebody from the Treasurer's Office to trick you up here and give us some testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kate Richardson, Chief of Staff, Oregon State Treasury. I'm here to speak to the second issue that Mr. Joseph articulated, and that is the amendment or the Section 3 of the bill, which addresses the lead plaintiff issue. A question has arisen, as Mr. Joseph articulated, about the interpretation of that of ORS 180.060 sub 3, and it's the interpretation that the Attorney General should not give legal advice to persons other than state officers. And so this means at this time that we are the person would be prevented from serving as a lead plaintiff in a federal securities class action suit. It is important to the Treasurer that the fund have the ability to serve as a lead plaintiff to preserve that option. As you know, the fund regularly participates in federal securities class action suits, but to date, Oregon has been unable to throw its hat in the ring to be a lead plaintiff in some of those issues or some of those cases. Pension funds from many other states, including California, New York, Wisconsin, Utah, Minnesota, Florida, have served as lead plaintiffs. We do not believe that this would be something that the fund would want to exercise particularly often, but right now we don't even have the option to serve as a plaintiff or have the judge appoint the fund as a plaintiff. We believe when it's beneficial to the fund's recovery, the fund should have the ability to join these other states in taking the lead to enforce the securities laws, and that's part of what helped keep our national securities markets free from fraud. Free from fraud, three times fast. The state could be in a better position as lead plaintiff potentially to negotiate and monitor attorney's fees and to oversee settlement discussions and case strategy. Oregon currently has the ability to opt out of these class actions and seek separate recourse, but we believe Oregon should, in the interests of its the funds it represents, have the flexibility to act as lead plaintiff in a particular case if the Attorney General, the Treasurer, and the appointed judge consider it appropriate. So we would ask your favorable consideration of this issue in House Bill 3329. And Mr. Bostrom, the Department of Justice, is also here to speak to that issue.
All right, sir. Chairman Innes, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss. I'm Assistant Attorney General and Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here to testify in favor of Section 3BB of House Bill 3329. From time to time, an Oregon state agency fund, such as OPR or the Common School Fund, may wish to serve as lead class plaintiff in securities class action in a securities class action lawsuit. This may occur when the fund has sustained the greatest loss of the class, when the fund would seek institutional reform of the defendant company, or when the fund has other reasons to control the litigation process. The Private Securities Litigation Reform Act favors institutional investors as lead plaintiffs in class action lawsuits. ORS 180-0603 prohibits the Attorney General from giving legal advice to anyone other than state agencies. The counsel for a lead plaintiff owes a duty to advise and represent not only the lead plaintiff, but also a duty to the class of investors represented by the class. The language in House Bill 3329 will relieve restrictions upon the Attorney General in this very narrow area, and I urge its passage. Thank you.
All right, any questions regarding this particular provision? It's constrained and restricted to securities only.
Correct.
All right, and this would take care of the Martha Stewart thing, right?
Absolutely.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burns.
Just to clarify that it is limited. We're not going to be facing situations where other people are trying to get services from you. There's no possibility that this will be perhaps used to divert the Attorney General into advising other people. You're confident of that?
Senator Burdick, it is narrowly crafted solely to securities class action litigation, and it is solely designed for the specific purpose that we've been testifying about.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Senator Walker.
Yeah, just one question. Okay. Mr. Boss, the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act, that's a federal act?
Senator Walker, yes.
Okay. Just wanted to clarify. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Your testimony. Let me see. AG's office. We've got the dash 10 amendments. I'm just looking at these, and it says they're repealed January 2nd of 04, but it's in effect until January 14th of 04. There's kind of a glitch here. Well, we can't hold up progress forever.
Mr. Chairman, I think I might be able to answer that. I believe this is a conversation I have with LC. I believe that there was a 30-day notice requirement in the contract. So at the time that this will be repealed, there will be less than 30 days to give notice to terminate. So it actually repeals, 13 days or 12 days beforehand. And so even at that point, there would be less than 30 days to give notice to terminate before the contract terminates under its own terms. So I think that's why it was written that way.
All right. Is that correct, Ms. Pellegrini?
I'm sorry. Yeah.
You have a 30-day notice requirement for your termination of the contract with the current provider. Is that correct?
That's correct. There's two provisions. One is 30 days if we're just not going to renew. And then there's another provision there that requires us to give them at least 60 days notice if there's another event that occurs. So,
all right. So what appears to be a glitch is not a glitch. All right. Thank you very much. And you made some egregious error by presenting false testimony in front of this committee.
I am very sorry. I did make an error. I corrected it in writing, and my sincere apologies.
I'm just kidding with you, by the way. I appreciate the correction.
Just say one more thing, Mr. Sure. Chair. On behalf of Attorney General Myers, he apologizes that he could not appear this morning before the committee. He is up in Bend, and he has convened. There's an Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force meeting that was previously scheduled there.
Probably on a golf course.
He's required to be up there. He phoned me at 9:30 last night, and I think that he was fully intending to be at the conference this morning.
Good. Okay, the golf is in the afternoon. Okay.
So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. All right. We're in work session. Jenny Burdick, Senator Tite, you've got an amendment here.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I do. I have the dash D8 amendments, which are constitute the language of the bill that we passed in the Senate to allow business lines and facsimile lines to be included on the no-call list. And that bill kind of disappeared into a closed committee in the House, so we thought we'd give it another shot in this friendly relating clause, and so that's what this is.
You give it another ring, not another shot.
Another ring.
So you're the gun thing, aren't you? All righty then. I suppose that those persons who oppose the bill are in opposition to the amendment. Would that be correct? And she gingerly wanders forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Julie Brandes, Associated Oregon Industries. We still have some concerns about the bill, yes. I think you understand that we didn't floor letter the bill or anything on the Senate side, floor letter against it. So we are concerned. First, let me be very clear, that the amendment to exempt the business-to-business contacts, I think, is helpful with many of the concerns that were expressed by our membership. We still have concerns for the same reasons that I expressed on the when the bill came through earlier, or the other bill, pardon me, that businesses still use telemarketers for a variety of reasons, including to develop markets for products that have not yet developed. For example, the legislature restructured the energy markets. That's a new market. We'd like to keep avenues open. Oops, that's my phone.
Your purse going off then?
I think so. I thought I had it on silent, but I didn't. The second concern we have is for other developing markets, but the second concern we have is we did get a copy of the letter that came out of legislative council that suggests that there are some constitutional problems when regarding free speech, but I'm not a lawyer and I'm not going to sit up here and trying to defend the council's position on that, legislative council's position on that.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to say that the source of the constitutional issues are the fact that there are exemptions in it. So the things that we've done to accommodate people are actually the source of the problem. So okay. I'm not expecting a lot of lawsuits on this.
Yeah, okay.
All right. Thank you very much. It seems kind of early, doesn't it, for Monday? All righty, we're in work session.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I would move the -B10 amendments to House Bill 3329.
Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the -B10 amendments to House Bill 3329. Discussion, we had the previous discussion about 30 days' notice. Senator Ferrioli, did you want to put anything on the record?
Well, I do, Mr. Chairman. Something about the agreement that runs, that went under the B-10, did we say?
B-10, correct.
It runs till January 14th, 2004. It occurs to me that there's a group of Oregonians who will be signing up for these services that with the expectation that they'll last a year. And so the contract only goes through January 14th, 2004, about another 6 months or so. There may be an education process at the very least to educate those consumers that the call list, no call list is shifted if that's the action that the legislature ultimately takes. The Attorney General could terminate this contract on the effective date of the passage of this legislation. And if that were the case, then that would create a breach of contract. And that might cause at least a cause of action in OTA. And that cause of action might be to recover damages. And the damages might be in the amount of the anticipated revenue under the contract. And I gather that would be negotiable between the Attorney General and OTA. And it struck me that it might be a good thing if consumers had a very clear message that the call list was going to change in nature and scope from an OTA program possibly to a federal program. It would be a good thing to end the expectation of the consumers that thought they were signing up for something that would last a year that will in fact be changed by legislative action. And it might be a good thing, in fact, to ask these parties, the Attorney General and OTA, to negotiate a settlement that would remedy the breach, that would eliminate the expectation that OTA would operate their program, and that would educate consumers that the there is a policy change that affects the milk colonies. And the parties to the agreement are available, I think, to talk about that. And I just was hoping that they would have an opportunity to discuss if we are going to anticipate, if we're going to take action on making a major policy shift, they could possibly discuss the implications for both the program, OTA, which has done an excellent job with the no call list in Oregon, I think everybody agrees, and is in a position to lose significant revenue and credibility if they promise services for a year and only can deliver 6 months. And the Attorney General, which might have a reason to enter into an agreement to terminate this no call list on the Oregon side immediately upon passage of the state legislature.
So this amendment precludes the Attorney General
from terminating it. It does.
Until January 14th.
Right, and I think that was in recognition that the company had done a good job and the Attorney General saw no reason to breach the contract. But if they were in breach, there might be a reason to negotiate liquidated damages.
No, it's not breaching the contract, it would be terminating it in accordance with the contract provision.
Under one scenario.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Joseph and Senator Walker.
If I take Senator Farioli's comments correctly, there could be a situation under which whether or not the designation, the Federalist, is considered a breach, that the parties to the contract might want to somehow stipulate to some kind of settlement or some kind of renegotiation of the contract. Reading this amendment, I have a little concern that the amendment would actually prohibit them from doing that. And if that was something that the committee wanted to leave the possibility open for, I have a conceptual amendment to B-10 that would probably accomplish that. So that the parties, if they wanted to, could stipulate to some type of settlement or renegotiation of the contract, whereas right now, if we pass the B-10 as you see them right before you, it puts the AG in a bind in that it cannot terminate the contract without violating this law. Now, the only party that might sue would be the no-call administrator, and if they stipulate some kind of settlement, I suppose, then there's probably not going to be a lawsuit anyway, but... there probably should be some language in this. In fact, what I would suggest is on line 4 after it says provision of the contract, comma, I might put in absent stipulation of the parties to the contract, the Attorney General may not terminate.
Mr. Chair, I don't think we need this because the sign-up time for getting on the no-call list has ended, which is my understanding. It's not. It's an ongoing process. Yeah, I'd like you to address that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini, Oregon Department of Justice. Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I believe what you're referring to is that currently the Oregon list is published quarterly. And so what you're referring to is the timeline, the deadline has now passed to sign up if you want your name or your number to be included on the list that will be published July 1. But people continue to sign up.
Okay.
One thing that we had at least discussed with Mr. Bennett when he was out here previously was the fact that if the contract were to continue through its current term and the list administrator wanted to continue to sign people up, speaking to Senator Farioli's comments, we do plan on having the administrator as well as the Attorney General notify consumers that, you know, if this bill passes, there is an alternative to signing up for the Oregon list. We'll be designated a federal list. They can sign up for free. They don't have to pay. We'd also contemplated perhaps having the list administrator begin to prorate the cost that it charged to consumers to sign up for the list after the date that we designated the state list to be the federal list, so that consumers would not fall short in terms of getting less services than they paid for.
Yeah. All right.
If you wanted to, if both sides wanted to negotiate a different agreement, for example, where they're held harmless through the length of their contract, but you know, maybe you make this shift sooner under some kind of settlement, maybe anticipated revenue that they would have received or whatever. Would that be possible under this amendment, or would we need the conceptual language?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I think we would feel more comfortable with Mr. Joseph's conceptual language in there, because it does permit the Attorney General to make alternative plans. I don't know that the Attorney General would ever take the position that, that he would engage in any actions that were contrary to legislatively enacted provision.
Well, go back over the language. I'm not sure. Joseph, I understand what you're
suggesting. And if you look at the dash B10 amendments on line 4, it says vision of the contract, comma, and after that it would say absent stipulation of the parties to the contract.
I'm sorry, absent.
Absent, as in I'm absent from school.
All right, I didn't hear the absent.
Yeah, absent stipulation of the parties to the contract, the Attorney General may not terminate the contract before January 14th, comma, 2004.
Mr. Chairman, that seems permissive to me, and it certainly doesn't harm the intent. So if the parties negotiate a settlement, that would be the deal. And if they are unable to negotiate a settlement, then the contract would run until January 14, 2004.
All right, then. Senator Burdick, with your permission, we just suspend the rules for the purpose of amending the 8-10 amendment.
I'm going to regret it, but I so move, Mr. Chairman.
All right, we do have a motion in possession to move the B-10 amendment. How about if you...
Mr. Chairman, I was going to withdraw my motion.
Okay. Senator Burdick withdraws her motion.
I move that we suspend the rules to insert language on line 4 of the dash 10 amendments after the word contract, comma, insert absent stipulation of the parties to the contract, comma, that's it.
All right, Senator Burdick moves. We suspend the rules. Did we already do that?
We did that.
So suspend the rules.
For the purposes.
So she's moving that we amend the B-10 amendment so that on line 4 after the word contract, comma, we insert the words absent the stipulation of the parties to the contract, comma.
Without the last comma, actually.
You added an extra thought.
Yeah. It would be after the contract, comma, absent stipulation of the parties to the contract. No other comma.
No, it does need a comma. I'm sorry.
I think.
Well, maybe we'll let Elsie massage.
We'll call it a Scrivener's thing. We'll do that first. Any objection to what we're intending to do here? Any discussion on it? No objection. Motion passes. There you go.
And Mr. Chairman.
Senator Purdy.
I move the dash B-10 amendments with the conceptual change.
Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the B-10 amendment as conceptual amendment by the committee. Any discussion? Any objection? Objection passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator,
that was my reward for that exercise. I would move the dash B-8 amendments. House Bill 3329.
Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the B-8 amendment. House Bill 3329. Discussion.
Go, Senator, go.
Is there objection to the motion? Chair will object. Objection is beyond that. Motion passes.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brady.
I move House Bill 3329 as amended to the Senate floor with a two-class recommendation.
Senator Burdick now moves House Bill 3329 as amended before the Senate with a two-class recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? There's none. We pass. Senator Burdick, you can carry the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I think I'm the only one who's good at this point.
All right. Any other business before the committee?
Senator Stark, who's the young lady that's in the audience?
The young lady visiting me today is Jennifer Nystrom, and she's going to be here shadowing me all the day long.
Or else she's looking for particularly bored, so.